This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Philadelphia yesterday, more than 40% of Disney stockholders withheld their support for Michael Eisner, a vote of no confidence that forced the Disney board to remove him as chairman, though he remains as chief executive officer. But at least Eisner's problems are restricted to the boardroom. The CEOs of WorldCom, Tyco, Adelphia, and Enron all face felony charges in court. In each case, at least part of the defense is that whatever may have happened was approved by the board of directors. So who is responsible, the CEO or the board? Later in the program, news that the mad cow case in Washington State may be different than first believe and that criminal charges may follow. But first, the relationship between CEOs and their boards of directors. What's the dynamic inside the boardroom? And is the goal consensus or contention? If you've sat on a board, what was it like? If you're a shareholder, do you throw away that proxy ballot without opening the envelope? And if you head up a company, what's your relationship like with members of your board? Give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin with more on the Disney case. Joining us on the phone from here in Washington is NPR correspondent Kim Masters, who's been covering the story. Kim, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So 43% was the vote against Mr. Eisner yesterday. I guess that really left the board no choice.
Well, I think that the shareholders who voted against Michael Eisner would argue that, that they still have no choice, and that, you know, that whatever the board did was, you know, just simply insufficient to address their concerns.
So this was the least they could do to try to paper over a deepening crisis?
Very much so. I mean, if you look at what George Mitchell received yesterday, he received a 24% no vote. Now, back when this started, a 24% no vote for Michael Eisner would have been considered remarkable. It was that George Mitchell's no vote was eclipsed by Michael Eisner's huge no vote, but it's still, it's more than Steve Case got in the thick of the AOL debacle. So it's a substantial no vote, and the signal is clear that splitting the jobs and making him, the chairman is not sufficient. This is something that was explicitly addressed by the leaders of the dissident movement, Stanley Gold and Roy Disney. They said this would not suffice.
Now, of course, George Mitchell, the former senator from Maine, the former Senate majority leader, has now been selected to replace Michael Eisner as chairman of the board. He was up until now, just before this, he was something called a presiding director. What was that?
Well, they were sort of edging up to this, and they had said quite explicitly quite recently that they would not be splitting these jobs in the immediate future. The presiding director was part of an attempt at reforming the board of Disney, which had been notoriously insular and, you know, had given Michael Eisner way too much control, according to anyone's appraisal who bothered to take, you know, magazines named it one of the worst boards in America. It was just like a poster child for bad boards.
And what was it that people found so bad about it? Were there too many insiders, too many friends of Michael Eisner?
Well, only if you count, you know, the principal of his children's school, his architect, his lawyer.
Why? They're totally independent.
Yes, and in fairness, you know, Roy Disney and Stanley Gold sat on that board quite happily when the stock was up for a long time. But the worm clearly has turned in this case, and the interesting thing, of course, in Michael Eisner's case is that in instituting these so-called reforms, all of them have managed to smite one of Eisner's enemies on the board. Somehow the rules that have been passed have pushed Roy Disney out, have pushed Stanley Gold out of key position, have pushed other people who complained about Michael Eisner out.
And there were two other members of the board who also got very high votes of no confidence, if you will. Tell us a little bit about them. Were they also Eisner pals?
I think that there are various groups that have various issues. Some of them are upset with the audit committee because Price Waterhouse has been allowed to do other work besides auditing. I mean, there's one of the fallback positions that Disney has taken is, oh, look at all these groups. They've all got different issues with different members of our boards. But, you know, of course, the inescapable fact is that the one thing they all agreed on was Michael Eisner.
Now, Michael Eisner is being sued by some shareholders. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's a the lawsuit that it predates Enron. It was when he fired Michael Ovitz, his friend, one-time friend, and mm-hmm. one-time Hollywood super agent, as the number two man in the company. And the allegation is that Michael Eisner acted completely unilaterally without consulting with the board at all. And very recently, even though this case dates back to 1996, very embarrassing correspondence has been unsealed by the court, which shows Michael Eisner, in fact, appearing to act quite unilaterally in not only hiring his friend to be the number two man in the company, but then quickly deciding that he had made a terrible mistake, firing him and still paying him more than $100 million to go away.
So what happens next?
You know, that is a good question. I mean, Michael Eisner was interviewed last night. He basically said that there was nothing unusual about this a 43% no vote, and that all of the allegations against him are false, except that he would not address them on a point-by-point basis.
And I must say that even his employee, Mr. Ted Koppel, found that a little hard to believe.
Yes, it was really quite an amazing thing. And so you sort of think, on the one hand, surely this board must be saying to him, you know, we need to look for an exit here. We'll give you as much dignity as we can, but this has got to stop. And on the other hand, you look at the person of Michael Eisner and the influence that he's wielded and the complete denial that I really think is not feigned. And I think he believes he will survive beyond his current contract. So it seems like the unstoppable force is now meeting the immovable object.
Well, we'll be watching to see what happens at
yes,
that collision.
It's better than what's on ABC.
Kim Masters, thanks very much.
Thank you.
NPR's Kim Masters speaking with us on the phone from here in Washington. If you'd like to join our conversation about the proper role of CEOs and boards of directors and how the dynamic happens in the boardroom, where a lot of very powerful men and women seem to often acquiesce with the chairman, the chief executive officer, give us a phone call. It's 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from her office in McLean, Virginia, is Nell Minow, editor of the Corporate Library. That's a website that tracks corporate governance, and it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Good to be here.
This relationship we've been hearing about between Michael Eisner and his board of directors, is that unusual? Is that typical?
Well, it is an extreme case. It really was astonishing that just a few years ago he had on, as Kim said, his kid's teacher, his other kid's principal, and his architect, his lawyer, and Sidney Poitier was also on that board. And it's not surprising that they then did not do a very good job. Whether they were fully participating in the Ovitz disaster or not, or the Katzenberg disaster or not, they allowed it to happen. And that's why it was frequently named as the worst board in America.
Mm-hmm. So that's an extreme case, but you'd think it would be in the CEO's interest to make sure that the board is well attended by his friends.
That's true, but fortunately, the board is not supposed to be there for the CEO's interest. They're supposed to be there for the shareholders' interest. And I think what has really changed is the understanding on the part of the investor community, particularly the institutional investor community, that the board is a significant risk factor. You know, it wasn't that long ago that O.J. Simpson was on the audit committee of Infinity Broadcasting, and everyone just thought that was kind of cute. But these days, they would not allow that to happen.
Is it common, and again, Michael Eisner was until yesterday, both the chairman of the board and the chief executive officer, is it common for one person to hold both those positions?
It's almost universal in the United States. Interestingly, in the UK, where they had a lot of board problems some years ago, they made it a priority to split the two jobs, and in a period of about 5 years, they went from almost universal joining of the two jobs to almost universal splitting. We have a report on our website of all the companies in America that do split them, but we are very clear in our report that in most of the cases, it really doesn't mean anything. The split is in name only.
Okay. For example, just today, Michael Dell, the founder and chairman of the chief executive officer of Dell Computers, stepped down as CEO to become chairman of the board.
Yeah, the same thing happened just a few months ago with Sandy Weill at Citigroup. And very often in the U.S., when the two jobs are split, it's done as a transitional matter for the new CEO to take over. But this is kind of a cowboy culture, and CEOs don't like anybody telling them what to do, and that's why they like to be the chairman, too. The reason it's a problem is that if you have the CEO as chairman, then he's deciding what the agenda is and what information goes to the other directors. And as we saw at Enron and Tyco and Global Crossing, that can be a disastrous combination.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Again, 800-989-8255, or email us, totn@npr.org. We'll begin with Ron, who's with us from Eugene, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi.
After doing pretty well in the software business in the late 90s, I'm now an active investor and own a number of stocks. And I am quite concerned about this emotional nepotism on the boards and, you know, the lack of true dialogue. Coincidentally, I'm also on the board of directors of our local electric co-op, which has a system where the nominating committee is entirely separate of the board, and you end up with candidates for the board that at times have absolutely no association other than being a member of the co-op, in effect a minor stockholder.
Mm-hmm.
What can be done about this emotional nepotism?
Well, what do you mean by emotional nepotism?
I know what he means by emotional nepotism.
Well, why don't you tell us then?
Well, what he's saying is that they may appear to be independent and that there's no sort of resume relationship, but that they start to become very attached to each other. It's a natural human impulse to dance with the one who brought you to the party. And that's why at our website, you know, we rate boards of directors, and some of that material is free. Some of it you have to pay for. But we rate boards of directors not based on what their indicia of independence are, but what their actual independence is. And so at Disney, what we were unhappy about at Disney was not that the kid's teacher was on the board. It's that the CEO pay was out of whack. If the board cannot tell the CEO what to do when it comes to pay, then they can't tell the CEO what to do in any other situation. And so that's really a very good guideline.
How do you measure independence?
You have to measure independence by the decisions they make. You know, you could take someone off the street that they've never seen before. That doesn't mean that they're going to have the spine and the intelligence and the experience to do the job right. And that's why we really have to look at the decisions they make. At our website, we rate them on CEO pay, on the transparency of the financial reporting, and on the overall strategy, because those are the toughest decisions given to the board.
Ron, go ahead.
Yes. You know, one of the things here is I don't understand why in this country that corporations, once they're public and owned by the shareholders, why the boards aren't responsible for bringing the best people to the table to act on behalf of the corporation, and why we have this history of allowing the CEO and the chairman of the board really to bring in these people. It seems so obviously counter to the success of the corporation to bring in a principal of a school. It's almost malfeasance.
Well, I agree with you. The problem is, you know, we use the term election, and yet it's more like, you know, a communist country than it is anything resembling democracy, because the CEO picks the candidates, no one runs against them, and the CEO counts the votes.
Absolutely. And, well, and this is the one place in America, I think, where politics, and I hate to say this, but politics actually has it over.
I agree with you completely. I know this is very important. There's a pending rule change at the Securities and Exchange Commission that would grant important new powers to shareholders to nominate directors, and Disney could be the test case. But business is opposing, surprise, surprise, business is opposing this rule. And people can still write into the SEC in support of the rule, because I think that will make a huge difference. It will make it possible for shareholders to nominate candidates without spending millions of dollars.
Ron,
thank you.
Thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it. And Nell, is that the only change that's emerged since all of the scandals?
I think one change that has really been underestimated in the Disney matter is that this is the first year that money managers and mutual funds have to disclose how they vote their proxies. In the past, they have always voted with management because they hope to get business from corporations, and they have not stood up for shareholder issues, even at companies like Disney that have had continuing corporate governance problems. I think that that's one reason that we saw this astonishing vote yesterday, is that for the first time, knowing that their votes are going to have to be disclosed, the mutual funds really stepped up to the plate.
We're talking about the relationship between CEOs and boards of directors, and when we come back from a break, we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about boards of directors, their roles, their responsibilities, and their relationship to the chief executive officer. You're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, or email us, TOTN@npr.org. We're speaking with Nell Minow, editor of the Corporate Library. It's a website that tracks corporate governance. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Larry, and Larry's with us on the phone from Boston.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I just wanted to observe something that I've seen in our work, and as we see a CEO, and he's just been terminated by his board, and he comes in and he says, "I thought this was just a regular meeting," and then it turns out that they fired me. You know, how could this be? There must have been a secret cabal of disgruntled board members who are working behind my back. How could this be?
You speaking from experience here, Larry?
Oh yeah, yeah. And,
as a board member or as a CEO?
I've served on a board. I've served on several boards, and we work with boards on sort of behavioral issues, behavioral decision making issues. And when you sort of look at the dynamics of what went on in these kind of archetype cases, it's often there's a process that goes on in the disenchantment cycle between boards and CEOs. And in the first phase of this disenchantment, board members who often are CEOs of their own companies treat the CEOs the way they themselves want to be treated on their boards, which is with a great deal of respect. And so often there are signals that are sent to the CEO, but the signals tend to be very, very subtle.
As in giving him enough rope to hang himself.
Oh, no, it's not like they want to give the person enough rope to hang himself. It's that they send signals, but they're not clear signals. At one of our companies, there's something called the nod. And the nod is a vertical inclination of the head from the ceiling towards the floor without any facial expression. And that could mean, I agree with what you just said, or it could mean, I understand what you just said, but I don't agree with it.
And
it has to be put in. It's a very subtle movement, but you have to understand what it means. I think what one of your guests was pointing out about Michael Eisner is CEOs. One of the reasons that CEOs are so effective is that they use denial as a defense mechanism quite often, and it also is their Achilles heel that they use denial as a defense mechanism. So when you have someone with a concentration of power who's both CEO and chairman of the board, and then the board is sending very subtle cues that they're dissatisfied, the CEO often doesn't pick it up.
Last one to figure it out. Does that sound familiar, Nell Minow?
Definitely. Definitely. I think one of the things that I've really worked hard on, and which I'm happy that the New York Stock Exchange has now required of all boards, is that the outside directors have to meet regularly in executive session without the senior management present. I think that's what you really need to have a, as we say in Washington, a free and frank exchange of ideas.
Yeah, the frank part is good. Thanks very much for the call, Larry.
My pleasure.
And just as a point of information, Nell, what's the typical number of people we're talking about in the boardroom of a Fortune 500 company? Is it 6, 12, 20?
It's usually about 12. Sometimes they go as high as 16, and occasionally they'll be an outrageous size like 20. But usually the average is about 12.
Well, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Nell Minow is editor of the Corporate Library, a website that tracks corporate governance, and she was with us from her office in McLean, Virginia. And with us now to talk a little bit more about the group dynamics that often goes on inside boardrooms is New Yorker staff writer James Surowiecki. Good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
And what we were just hearing about, that dynamic that was being described by our caller, does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah, I think the phrase emotional nepotism was actually an excellent way of putting it. I mean, one of the things that I find very interesting is that, as the last caller said, many board members are CEOs in their own right. The vast majority of them, if they're not CEOs, are, you know, very accomplished figures in their own fields, and they tend to be very assertive people on their own. But somehow, when they get into the boardroom, they often become quite deferential toward the CEO's whims. And I think one of the reasons, well, there are a variety of reasons, but one of them certainly is that there is this sense that the CEO, as kind of an imperial leader, deserves a certain amount of respect and deference. And so people are remarkably unwilling to voice dissent, even when bad decisions are being made.
You write about the effort, what you call groupthink, is the effort to everybody, though they are a group of alpha males and queen bees, as you describe them, once they get inside that room, they want to reach consensus. They want to be team players.
Yeah, I think, I mentioned in there the Enron board, and one of the fascinating things about the Powers report and the Senate committee report, there were two very long and detailed reports on what the Enron board did, is that almost always the Enron board acted unanimously. In fact, the board members, when they were interviewed, said that they could only remember, I think, two times in the last, say, decade when there was real dissent. And to me, that was a sign that something was wrong not just because the decisions that Enron was making were obviously flawed, but because in general, that's a sign that people are not thinking independently. But they saw it as a sign of how cohesive the group was, how harmonious things were, and, that's the idea that a lot of boards have, that you need to all be on the same page.
Well, you cite in your own piece a recent Harvard report on boardroom dynamics that says when members of the board express skepticism about management proposals, it undermines the supportive climate that's important for the CEO to succeed.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most fascinating things. That was actually from a symposium at which, in general, the general feeling was, boards needed to be more serious about their responsibilities and they needed to, think harder about strategy. But they basically did reach this conclusion that CEOs needed a lot of support in order to push their ideas through. And I was fascinated by that because if you think about, the typical picture of the CEO, he's a guy who's very sure of himself, doesn't need, to be constantly coddled or had to have his back slapped. And yet the image was that if a director suggested that the CEO was maybe making a mistake, that would somehow throw off the company's entire efforts. And I think that's a really ill-considered way to go about thinking about what boards are supposed to do.
As an example, you cite Alfred Sloan, who ran General Motors for about a quarter of a century there, and says at a meeting, "Gentlemen, I take it we're all in complete agreement on the decision here. Then I propose we postpone further discussion to give ourselves time to develop disagreement and perhaps gain some understanding of what this decision is all about."
Yeah, Sloan is a fascinating figure because, Alfred Sloan, who was head of GM really from about 1920 on for almost 30 years and then continued as chairman of GM for another maybe 15 or 20 years, he really in a lot of ways invented the modern corporation. But the fascinating thing is if you go back and look at Sloan, he was incredibly invested in what he called team management and very invested in making sure that a lot of different voices were heard and that decisions weren't put through simply because they were his decisions or they were his ideas. And so it's very interesting because he really was he set the model in so many ways for what CEOs are supposed to be. But in this very important way, CEOs have basically ignored his example and I think have basically assumed, as you have been talking about, that the best thing for them was if, they have the most compliant board possible.
Here's an email question from Chris Franco in San Diego. Is it common for certain board members and the CEOs they work with in one corporation to also work in reversed roles in another corporation, or is that not allowed?
It is allowed. I couldn't tell you what the numbers are. They're definitely, and this is, I think, one of the things that's probably getting a little bit better. But one of the problems certainly is that people sit on, many boards together, or they sit on each other's board. Economists sometimes call them interlocking directorates,
mm-hmm.
And that obviously is a problem because it creates a I scratch your back, you scratch mine. But one problem is that even when you don't have a direct relationship like that, one problem with having so many CEOs on boards when it comes to say corporate pay is that corporate pay is generally set. CEO pay is generally set in a kind of comparative way. So a company will say, "Well, we want our CEO to be paid, as more than 75% of other CEOs." But that means every CEO on a board has an investment in jacking up the CEO's salary because they know they'll eventually reap the benefits. So there is this kind of systematic problem with the way compensation is determined.
Another email, this comes from Henry in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Boards, he writes, are good old boy clubs that serve at the pleasure of the CEO. It's time to change the rules, he says. Board members should be required to buy shares of stock so they have a vested interest in what they're doing and only allowed to to sell with full and prior disclosure, with adequate lead time for all shareholders to understand and check their reasons.
I would agree with both of those. The first one I think is especially important. This idea of the boards being good old boy clubs. I do think there is a movement away from that. I think that the Disney case is certainly going to do that. Another one is this the situation at Hollinger International, where Conrad Black, basically had constructed this board of friends and cronies and is now paying the price for that. But I really do think boards of directors need to step up. I also agree with the share ownership thing. One of the things that's been done is giving board members a lot of stock options. And we know that there are all these flaws with stock options. And I think buying shares is something that forcing directors to buy shares is a very good idea. On the other hand, a lot of the boards that we've seen get into a lot of trouble, like the Enron board, a lot of those directors had sizable stakes in the companies, and it didn't seem to stop them from making bad decisions.
Let's get a caller on the line. Frank is with us from Auburn, California.
Yes, I've often wondered why this kind of goes along with the email question. Why aren't boards of directors a combination of workers and shareholders? Seems like that way they're the ones that have the most interest in the company succeeding.
Well, obviously in Germany it is that way. There is a co-management. Workers have representatives on every board. I think the reason it's not done that way in the United States is that in the United States, corporations are run for the shareholders. I mean, that's sort of their legal, I think in almost every case, that's their legal charter. And you can certainly imagine situations in which the interests of workers and the interests of shareholders are not harmonious, basically. And so I think that's the simple legal reason. I actually think the idea of diversifying the membership of boards is a good idea. The problem with having an institutionalized worker representation is that I think, basically shareholders would not be guaranteed that their interests would be necessarily looked after.
And you could also see every meeting becoming at least partly a contract negotiation.
Exactly. And I think that's really the concern that people have, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I still think it's a good idea.
Well, I mean, one way of thinking about it is that a worker is always going to workers are generally always – their interest is always going to be served by the corporation continuing to – let's just take the most extreme example. Workers are always going to be best served by having the corporation continue to exist. But it may be that for shareholders and even in a kind of broader sense for, the efficiency of the market, that it may be best for a company to be acquired by another company or to downsize its workforce or to even go out of business potentially.
Uh-huh.
And it's very hard to imagine workers voting for that, even though so the shareholders own the company. That's the idea, is that the director should represent the people who own it. But, it really is a conceptual thing. In Germany, the thinking is much more along the lines of what you're talking about.
Frank, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate the phone call.
Uh-huh, bye.
And James Surowiecki, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me on.
James Surowiecki's piece about boardroom dynamics appears in the current issue of The New Yorker magazine, and he was speaking with us on the phone from his office in New York. We're talking about boards of directors and chairman and chief executive officers. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now from his office in Minneapolis is someone who's been in all of the corporate seats we've been talking about this hour. Bill George is the former CEO of Medtronic, a medical technology company. At one time, while CEO, he was also the chairman of Medtronic's board of directors. He currently sits on the boards of Goldman Sachs, Novartis, and Target, and he's written a book called Authentic Leadership, Rediscovering the Secrets to Creating Lasting Value. And Bill George, it's good to have you back on the program.
Nice to be back, Neil.
You've been listening to this discussion so far, the group dynamics that James Surowiecki was talking about. Does that sound familiar to you from your time at Medtronic?
I think he's on the money as far as the group dynamics being essential, but I think we're generalizing too much around the examples of some bad boards. There are sharp distinctions, Neil, between good boards and bad boards. The board at Medtronic was had what I would call an honest dialogue and sharp disagreements at every board meeting, and I was always challenged as CEO. And frankly, I invited it. I learned a lot, and the board kept management from making some bad decisions and empowered us to make some decisions that turned out very well. So I think a lot of it depends, everything depends upon the relationship between the board and the CEO and whether that honest dialogue and disagreements are encouraged. I was in the same symposium he was in, and I know we at Harvard, and we talked a lot about the importance of board chemistry and having those disagreements. And it looks like on the Disney board over the last 10 years or so, there's been very little disagreement brooked. And in contrast to that, with the Target board, in which I've served for a dozen years, we have very very sharp discussions and oftentimes significant disagreements. But I think that's a very healthy thing.
Remind us, when we're talking about these groups, how big are they?
Around 12 people. Typically, you'll have, 10 outsiders and one or two insiders, something like that, on most boards. The Goldman Sachs board's about that size. I'm on the Novartis board. It's about that same size.
Okay. Let's get a caller on the line. Dee is with us from Austin, Texas.
Hi. How are you?
I'm very well.
Well, that's good. The reason I'm calling, I was on a board, and I resigned, and I'm also on another board now. But one of the boards I was on was a nonprofit board. And a large decision needed to be made, and instead of going out for bids for a new computer system, they let people that have been on the board for some time make decisions so they don't hurt their feelings. And this decision they made, they were going to end up needing to redo the whole thing in 2 years. They didn't know anything about routers or networking, things of that sort. And the board that I'm on now, when newer people are on the board. I'm on this board now for going on the second year. People that have been on the board for quite some time, they really, they're not open to new ideas. They want to control it. They know how it's worked before, and it's going to work that way now. And it's like, why are we here?
Bill George, to begin with, is there a distinction between boards of companies and nonprofits?
Well, yes, nonprofit boards tend to be larger, and in many cases they don't represent shareholders because there are no shareholders, so they're representing a community force, and oftentimes those boards tend to be more representative, and in general it's much more difficult to have a representative board. I'm very strong in my belief that all board members represent the whole institution.
And in Dee's example that she's talking about, in this other company that she was on the board of, are people who've been there a long time, do they get a little too married to the company?
It can happen. I think, Neil, it's good to have clear tenure limits on the board, say 15 years, to have age limits, say 70. Boards need to have this to ensure rotation of people off the board and bringing vital new members on the board. But I think you need a mix of both. You don't want an all-new board. That's one of the risks, that you lose an institutional memory. So you want to have board members that have had that institutional memory, but you also want to bring in diverse opinions, diverse life experiences. And I think that's essential to have this honest discussion and disagreement. Otherwise, you do run the risk of everyone thinking the same or falling into a comfortable pattern while the organization may be going down the tubes.
Dee, thanks very much.
Thanks so much. Have a good day.
You too. When we come back from a short break, we'll wrap this discussion up with Bill George and then turn to a reporter at the Seattle Times to talk about the latest developments in the Mad Cow investigation. Some criminal charges, it turns out, could be involved. Maybe that cow was not a downer cow after all. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're wrapping up our discussion about the relationship between CEOs and boards of directors. Our guest is Bill George, former CEO and chairman of Medtronic. He sits also on the boards of several companies. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. And let's go to Michael. And Michael's on the phone with us from Cambridge,
hello.
Massachusetts. Yes, Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a point of information question. How much are board members paid to be members of boards, and how much are they paid to come to each meeting? I heard that they were also reimbursed for that.
Bill George?
And how does that influence, perhaps, how they behave?
Okay.
Well, it can range anywhere. I'd say the total annual compensation from around, for a smaller company, is $30,000 to $40,000, up to a couple hundred thousand for the larger companies. By the way, the time that's required for boards today has grown tremendously through Sarbanes-Oxley, particularly serving on an audit committee, where audit committees used to meet 4 times a year, and typically they're meeting now 10 to 12 times a year.
And does that require a fair amount of travel as well?
It does. It does. When I go to Novartis 11 times a year, I have to travel from living in Cambridge, now teaching at Harvard, over to Basel, Switzerland. So it takes a lot of time. But I can assure you it's well worth it. But one point I'd like to make, Neil, is that I think we've these examples of almost every company that's failed has been from bad governance, whether it's Enron or WorldCom, and some of the problems, and Tyco, the problems we're having at Disney and other places. But, you know, we need to also get out the examples of excellent boards like the board of PepsiCo or the board of GE or board of Procter & Gamble or some of the boards I've served on like Goldman Sachs and Target, and look at what are the differences there. Why do these companies do better? And I think you'll see in those sharp differences in this board chemistry that James was talking about earlier, where boards really work well together and can help guide the corporation, where the CEO really honestly wants the board's opinion. You don't put people on your board of the caliber we have and then not ask their opinion, but many CEOs don't want it, and so I wouldn't serve on a board like that. But I think there are excellent examples out there as well.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
Here's an email question from Saratoga, California. I attend tens of stockholder meetings each year, and what surprises me is so few shareholders ever ask the CEO or the board questions during the meeting. Why are shareholders so quiet and not pushing the board more actively? Is it because the financial statements are so hard to understand?
Well, Neil, I recall as CEO of Medtronic, we had what amounted to a full hour of questions at every annual meeting. And very thoughtful questions from shareholders. We encourage shareholders to come. We always had 2,000 or 3,000 shareholders that showed up, and they were very good, thoughtful questions. And so we encourage that. I know some boards have discouraged that forum, but I think it's important. Shareholders have a right to know what's going on inside their companies. They own the company, and that's the time for the management and the board to step forward and to respond to them. So I think that dialogue can be very healthy as well.
Is the percentage of shareholders who actually get actively involved, is that going up in your perception?
I think only in a case where you have bad situations, like we saw in Philadelphia yesterday. I think in general it's not going up, and I think it would be healthy. Many institutional shareholders don't really want to get involved, and I think it's good for them to particularly come to a public forum and have that kind of dialogue.
Let's get another caller on the line. Roger's with us from Wolfboro, New Hampshire.
I have a question for Nell. Could her organization promote the idea of stockholders being able to buy videos of directors' meetings? I can't believe that these meetings are all unanimous. There must be good fights in some of them, and it would help us to be part of the corporation to have a video.
Nell's not with us, but we'll put the question to Bill George.
Well, I think in the public part of the session, that'd be an interesting thing to do. I do think also, though, and under law now, it's required to meet in executive session with the CEO and without the CEO present. I think those meetings have to be in private, but those are the most interesting meetings because that's where you get into the really tough discussions and everything is laid out. And to me, healthy boards have those kind of discussions, whether they're for-profit or not-for-profit. And it's vital to that being having a healthy board chemistry.
And that's where, if there's going to be discussion about the CEO, that's where it's going to start.
Well, you know, if you look at the Disney situation, no one's talking about the elephant on the table. That's CEO succession. And that's the board's first job, is to ensure you have success and lined up. We spend hours on every board I'm on, many hours per year, at least two meetings, talking about the issue of succession, both short-term, immediate succession, and longer-term, and who's being developed for all the top jobs. And I think a board has a real responsibility, Neil, to spend a lot of time on the succession question and not let the CEO say, well, you know, they didn't want to discuss it. You have to discuss it. If the CEO won't, then you discuss it without him there or without her there. But succession is crucial. And that's the elephant on the table that's so often not discussed.
One last call for Bill George. Slayman is with us on the line from Tallahassee.
Hello. My question is, and thank you for taking my call,
sure,
is whether or not it's possible for one person who's like a billionaire to be able to entirely control a company if they could buy out all of the shares.
Absolutely. If you own all the shares, you can control the company. I think, of course, these large publicly held companies like the boards on which I serve, that would be very, very hard to do. And so you don't tend to see that. But sometimes companies do go private. And sometimes you have very large shareholders sitting on boards. And again, it's important they represent the long-term interests of the shareholders. If that's the only way you're going to create, as I talk about in my book, Authentic Leadership, you only can create lasting value for all the shareholders and all the stakeholders, I might add.
And there are also family corporations where various members of the family may own very large shares of stock.
Yeah, and even in the case of Dell today, I thought it was very much to Michael Dell's credit that he turned the CEO job over to Kevin Rollins and realizing it's not just his company anymore, but it's a public company. He's made enormous contributions and built a very valuable franchise, and he wants to see that preserved so it'll be there for the long term and not go the way of some other companies which have disappeared from the scene.
Slayman, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And if you weren't with us earlier, we did mention that Michael Dell, the founder and CEO of Dell, has left that job to become chairman of the board and appointed, as you just heard, a replacement. So that's awfully big news in Austin, Texas, and the computer business. Bill George, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Neil. Good to be with you.
Bill George, former CEO of Medtronic, the author of Authentic Leadership, Rediscovering the Secrets to Creating Lasting Value.